Beyond presents spoilers for The Tragedy of Dido, Queen of Carthage by Christopher Marlowe and Thomas Nash. Discuss. Today we're looking at Act 4 in detail, following are some introductory notes, intercut with a rough mix of our recording of the play. The same plain text edit will then follow for those who want to hear the text without interruptions. It was produced at the White Bear Theatre as part of our 2023 Revel season. There will be a better final cut which will follow this release, and as a live recording, there are some minor errors from the heat of the dramatic moment. If you want to just enjoy our production, stop listening now and wait for the release. Or if you're listening in the future, look for the episode further up in the podcast list. This is an exercise that some listeners just aren't interested in. If it ain't for you, move on. If you're still listening, let's enter spoiler land.
Spoiling things, things get spoiled in spoiler land.
So, Act 4 is, like Act 3, a fairly busy act, with five brisk scenes bobbing about. Well, say five brisk scenes, at least two of them sort of run into each other. And talking about bobbing about, we return to the action post-action, post-coitus, as the interval has been all about the sweet, sweet lovemaking of Dido and Aeneas. This quickly moves to Iarbas making a hate sacrifice, a rejection of Anna, Aeneas flip-flopping about leaving Carthage, Dido pulling up the drawbridge, and then a rather interesting scene with Cupid. A stage crowded with fast-flowing incident before the final, drawn-out, horrifying conclusion to Act 5. So, Act 4, Scene 1. Enter Achates, Cupid as Ascanius, Iarbas and Anna. This is following the interval, a mini music break back in the day, and ice creams and a loo break for us in the present time. We are introduced to the hunting party, who marvel at the unexpected rainstorm. They've clearly never been to Margate on a bank holiday.
Did ever men see such a sudden storm, or day so clear, so suddenly o'ercast?
I think some fell enchantress dwelleth here, that can call them forth when as she please, and dive into black tempest treasury, when as she means to mask the world with clouds.
In all my life I never knew the like. It hailed, it snowed, it lightened all at once.
I think it was the devil's revelling night there was such hurly-burly in the heavens. Doubtless Apollo's axle-tree is cracked, or aged Atlas' shoulder out of joint the motion was so over-violent.
In all this coil, where have ye left the queen?
Nay, where's my warlike father? Can you tell?
Cupid as Ascanius, cueing Aeneas and Dido to enter from the cave. And Iarbas there, still on point as he doesn't care about the weather, where's the queen? And when they do enter, hair astray, garments slightly askew, Iarbas' angry asides get hot. Post-coital, Aeneas and Dido are blissfully unaware. Or just uninterested.
Behold, where both of them come forth the cave.
Come forth the cave. Can heaven endure this sight? Iarbas, curse that unrevenging Jove, whose flinty dart slept in Typhus' den, whilst these adulterers surfeited with sin. Nature, why mayst be not some poisonous beast, that with the sharpness of my edged sting I might have staked them both unto the earth whilst they were sporting in this darksome cave?
The air is clear, and the southern winds are whist. Come, Dido, let us hasten to the town, since gloomy Aeolus doth cease to frown.
Achates and Ascanius, well met.
Fair Anna, how escaped you from the shower?
As others did. By running to the wood.
But where were you, Iarbas, all this while?
Not with Aeneas in the ugly cave.
I see. Aeneas sticketh in your mind. But I will soon put by that stumbling block and quell those hopes that thus employ your cares.
And they exeunt, or do they? Here's another moment in the play where moments seem to elide into each other, as the next scene seems to be a totally different scene with a new locus, and also follows on naturally from the previous scene. So, Act 4, Scene 2, enter Iarbas to sacrifice. Now, so tonally, there is, however, no gap here. Iarbas goes direct from the snub by Dido at the end of the last scene to this sacrifice of hate. And I mean, for us today, there's no problem with this as a staging issue. We just leave him on stage, change the lighting design to suggest the new locus, maybe fly in a bit of additional scenery and bam, you're there. So it's an interesting question as to whether the early modern stage would do the same. Obviously not lighting design or literal things like that. But normally we'd be going, well, maybe there's a missing scene or there's something not right here. But it just feels so right. And maybe he's just randomly sacrificing in the woods. Maybe that's just what he's doing. It doesn't feel that makes any sense. But again, stage logic like this doesn't have to make literal sense in that sense. And of course, the play has already done this with the shift from the godly realm to the outskirts of Carthage in Act 1. So I don't think there is a gap or a missing scene. I think this is what the play is aiming for, riding the emotional core of the end of the previous scene directly into this one. So don't have Iarbas exit and come on again. That'd be really weird. Have the scene change around him. Have the servants who enter dress him and move on. Anyway, let the hate flow.
Come, servants. Come, bring forth the sacrifice, that I may pacify that gloomy Jove, whose empty altars have enlarged our ills.
Servants bring in the sacrifice, and then exeunt is the usual gloss here. The script doesn't say, you know, we could have assistance to this sacrifice. And it doesn't say what this ritual sacrifice entails, or entrails. Is this an animal sacrifice? I mean, it's messy, but quite effective if you can make it look real. Is there a fire element here? Because fire will be used later. Is this the same fire effect for Act 5, or a smaller foreshadowing, as with the fire in Act 1? And if it is an animal sacrifice, what animal? Which pushes us closer to a Christian view of black magic and the dangerous evil of pagan worship, which the original audience would have found more disturbing than we would. It could be all a bit Charles Grey in The Devil Rides Out, if we're not careful.
Eternal Jove, great master of the clouds, father of gladness and all frolic thoughts, that with thy gloomy hand corrects the heaven when airy creatures war amongst themselves. Hear Iarbas plaining prayers, whose hideous echoes make the welkin howl, and all the woods Eliza to resound. The woman that thou willed us entertain, where straying in our borders up and down, she craved a hide of ground to build a town, with whom we did divide both laws and land, and all the fruits that plenty else sends forth. Scorning our loves and royal marriage rites, yields up her beauty to a stranger's bed, who, having wrought her shame, is straightway fled. Now, if thou beest a pitying god of power, on whom ruth and compassion ever waits, redress these wrongs, and warn him to his ships that now afflicts me with his flattering eyes.
Having got that off his chest, and firmly in the Get Rid of Aeneas camp, enter Anna, who, as we have established, has a bit of an Iarbas crush, and so wants to help Iarbas. Except for one detail of what he wants.
How now, Iarbas? At your prayers so hard?
Aye, Anna. Is there aught you would with me?
Nay, no such weighty business of import, but may be slacked until another time. Yet, if you would partake with me the cause of this devotion that detaineth you, I would be thankful for such courtesy.
Anna, against this Trojan do I pray, who seeks to rob me of thy sister's love, and dive into her heart by coloured looks.
Alas, poor king, that labours so in vain, for her that so delighteth in thy pain. Be ruled by me, and seek some other love, whose yielding heart may yield thee more relief.
Seek some other love, pointing gestures, me, hint, hint. Iarbas, however, cannot change his direction. And here's a question. I mean, has Iarbas enough emotional literacy to have noticed that Anna likes him? Is her confession of love, in a moment, an actual surprise to him? I suspect not, but, I mean, he's not a subtle guy, so maybe he genuinely hasn't noticed and everybody else has.
Mine eye is fixed where fancy cannot start. Oh, leave me. Leave me to my silent thoughts that register the numbers of my ruth, and I will either move the thoughtless flint or drop out both mine eyes in drizzling tears before my sorrow's tide have any stint.
I will not leave Iarbas, whom I love, in this delight of dying pensiveness. Away with Dido! Anna, be thy song. Anna, that doth admire thee more than heaven.
I may, nor will list to such loathsome change that intercepts the course of my desire. Servants, come fetch these empty vessels here, for I will fly from these alluring eyes that do pursue my peace where'er it goes.
Ouch. Exit Iarbas. Anna calls after.
Iarbas, stay. Loving Iarbas, stay. For I have honey to present thee with. Hard-hearted wilt not deign to hear me speak. I'll follow thee with outcries nevertheless, and strew thy walks with my dishevelled hair.
Exit Anna, and here we return to that question of agency. Is Anna also hit with Cupid? Because, otherwise, I mean, this is just a little demeaning, isn't it? Everyone is acting like horny teenagers, which is, of course, who was playing the text in the original run. Everyone was a horny teenager in the original show. Everyone running for inappropriate love interests and willing to do anything for it, even reduce themselves. Teenagers, hey? I don't miss it. Act 4, Scene 3. Enter Aeneas, and Aeneas has completely flip-flopped on his promises to Dido. This is quite absolute and almost surprising, actually, because whilst we know the story and there are lots of hints that he's sort of wanting to get back to war and in his old life, and Dido definitely has made all the running in the relationship, but even so, they have just shared a moment, and it's all a bit public now, and this running away at that time is, this really is the time when Aeneas really is being a selfish arsehole. But there are plenty of ways for the actor to work with this, because the actor needs to find a route through, and, I mean, it's all there. The damage and the trauma of Troy, and now this sudden intimacy, and a new home, a new potential wife, and, of course, he's itching to get away. He has a destiny. And, you know, Let's give him a little bit of slack here. He literally does have a destiny. I mean, there are gods standing over him with shiny destiny letters. The gods have told him he has... I kind of ordered him to do it. So again, in this decision, how much agency does he have? Still a bit of a love rat, though. You know, he's still a bit shitty.
Carthage, my friendly host, adieu. Since destiny doth call me from thy shore, Hermes this night, descending in a dream, hath summoned me to fruitful Italy. Jove wills it so, my mother wills it so. Let my Phoenicia grant, and then I go. Grant she or no, Aeneas must away, whose golden fortunes, clogged with courtly ease, cannot ascend to fame's immortal house, or banquet in bright honour's burnished hall, till he hath furrowed Neptune's glassy fields and cut a passage through his topless hills. Achates, come forth! Segestus, Ilioneus, Cloanthus, haste away! Aeneas calls.
Enter Achates, Cloanthus, Segestus, and Ilioneus, the yes-men who have no souls. Aeneas is genuinely torn. Dido and fate calls. Who to follow? Achates and the chaps lean towards soldiering. Rah!
What wills our lord, or wherefore did he call?
The dreams, brave mates, that did beset my bed when sleep but newly had embraced the night, commands me leave these unrenowned realms, whereas nobility abhors to stay, and none but base Aeneas will abide. Aboard, aboard, since fates do bid aboard, and slice the sea with sable-coloured ships, on whom the nimble winds may all day wait, and follow them as footmen through the deep. Yet Dido casts her eyes like anchors out, to stay my fleet from loosing forth the bay. Come back, I hear her cry afar, and let me link thy body to my lips, that tied together by the striving tongues we may as one sail into Italy.
And now we get some really quite toxic masculinity from the chaps. These women and their dalliance, they effeminate our minds. So remember the depiction of Ganymede at the top of the play. The play has shown us wanton, effeminate dalliance, and it's not exactly in favour. That said, these guys aren't exactly moral exemplars.
Banish that ticing dame from forth your mouth and follow your foreseeing stars in all. This is no life for men-at-arms to live, where dalliance doth consume a soldier's strength and wanton motions of alluring eyes effeminate our minds inured to war.
Why, let us build a city of our own and not stand lingering here for amorous looks. Will Dido raise old Priam forth his grave and build the town again the Greeks did burn? No, no, she cares not how we sink or swim, so she may have Aeneas in her arms.
To Italy, sweet friends, to Italy! We will not stay a minute longer here.
Trojans aboard, and I will follow you.
Exeunt all except Aeneas. Hi-ho! Aeneas is left to ponder. He is still torn, or perhaps he is feeling a tad bit guilty, because he should, because he is.
I fain would go, yet beauty calls me back. To leave her so, and not once say farewell, were to transgress against all laws of love. But if I use such ceremonious thanks as parting friends accustom on the shore, her silver arms will call me round about, and tears of curls cry, stay, Aeneas, stay. Each word she says will then contain a crown, and every speech be ended with a kiss. I may not endure this female drudgery. To see, Aeneas, find out Italy.
Oh, such drudgery to be kissed. Exit Aeneas, and another short scene ends. Kinda. We flipped to the other side of the non-functioning relationship, as Dido has heard that Aeneas might be legging it. Again, this is kinda not a new scene. It's the same relative locus, and it has a revolving door quality, straight off from one side, straight on from another. Anna is sent to get news, while Dido is enraged at Aeneas's lack of gratitude. And the fact that she wants him to stay. Act 4, Scene 4. Enter Dido and Anna.
Oh, Anna, run unto the waterside. They say Aeneas's men are going aboard. It may be he will steal away with them. Stay not to answer me. Run, Anna, run. Oh, foolish Trojans that would steal from hence and not let Dido understand their drift. I would have given Achates store of gold and Ilonius gum and Libyan spice, the common soldiers' rich embroidered coats and silver whistles to control the winds which Circe sent to Caius when he lived. Unworthy are they of a queen's reward. See where they come. How might I do to chide?
Re-enter Anna with Aeneas, Achates, Cloanthus, Ilioneus, suggests all the chaps, and Carthaginian lords. So this is a very public scene with a crowded stage, and Dido has also got some muscle with her, with these lords of Carthage, one of which will get a line later. Anna reports that Aeneas was about to run. Aeneas does some tactical lying. I was just saying goodbye to me mates. You know, I just happened to be on board. But I only had a shipboard pass. It's fine. The lie unravels as they try to still get on board together. And when that doesn't work, Aeneas says, oh, Achates can't sail now. I mean, the weather isn't good. Yeah.
'Twas time to run. Aeneas had been gone. The sails were hoisting up and he aboard.
Is this thy love for me?
Princely Dido, give me leave to speak. I went to take my farewell of Achates.
How haps Achates bid me not farewell?
Because I feared your grace would keep me here.
To rid thee of that doubt, aboard again! I charge thee, put to sea and stay not here.
Then let Aeneas go aboard with us.
Get you aboard! Aeneas means to stay.
The sea is rough. The winds blow to the shore.
Oh, false Aeneas. Now the sea is rough. But when you were aboard, 'twas calm enough. Thou and Achates meant to sail away.
Which is fair comment. But Aeneas has a get-out-of-jail card of excuses. Oh, how could I leave? You've got my son.
Hath not the Carthage queen mine only son? Thinks Dido I will go and leave him here.
Well, that's quite an interesting question, Aeneas. You didn't seem that fussed before, so were you planning on leaving your child behind? Or had you forgotten you had a son? Because, I mean, then Aeneas is starting to seem even worse than a love rat. This is a contradiction or a plot hole that has been noted before. It's not a new thing. And the question about, does this really work? It's a sort of convenient way of pivoting the scene, but it does sort of put a hole in the waterline of Aeneas' thinking here. It is quite weird. But hopefully it's the kind of a bit weird that people only think about when they're in the car on the way home from the production, not actually during it, because the action's moving really quickly and hopefully nobody really will notice. Dido is assuaged by this point. I mean, it's a fair point. You know, she's still got his son. So he gets a crown and some jewels and she gets a kiss. Again, this thing of clothing literally changing who a character is. This is a mini public coronation. If the earlier announcement of Aeneas and Dido being together was semi-public, it was mostly in a court, this is a public declaration of what has been known but not fully announced so far.
Aeneas, pardon me, for I forgot that young Ascanius lay with me this night. Love made me jealous, but to make amends, wear the imperial crown of Libya. Sway thou the Punic scepter in my stead and punish me, Aeneas. For this crime.
This kiss shall be fair Dido's punishment.
Oh, how a crown becomes Aeneas' head. Stay here, Aeneas, and command as king.
How vain am I to wear this diadem, and bear this golden sceptre in my hand? A burgess of steel and not a crown, a sword and not a sceptre fits Aeneas.
But the costume doesn't fit. He can't keep lying. He tries to take them off. And Dido tries to big up the look. No, it's so you. Yeah, I mean, you look like Jove. You know, who we met earlier in the play.
Oh, keep them still. And let me gaze my fill. Now looks Aeneas like immortal Jove. Oh, where is Ganymede to hold his cup and Mercury to fly for what he calls? 10,000 cupids hover in the air and fan it in Aeneas' lovely face. Oh, that the clouds were where he in the, that fleds, and thou and I unseen might sport ourselves. Heaven, envious of our joys, is waxen pale, and when we whisper, then the stars fall down to be partakers in our honey talk.
And Aeneas goes for it. He's all in Team Dido. I mean, is this a lie? Is he just a bit weak-willed and flip-flops the moment an idea is thrown at him? I've never been on a quest and tempted by a kingdom before, so I don't know. You know, I've never had a queen throw herself at me while I'm trying to go off and found a colonial enterprise in Italy. I don't know.
Oh, Dido, patroness of all our lives, when I leave thee, death be my punishment. Swell, raging seas, frown wayward destinies, blow winds, threaten ye rocks and sandy shelves. This is the harbour that Aeneas seeks. Let's see what tempests can annoy me now.
Oh, not all the world can take thee from mine arms.
And here we have the first of two lines that raise, in an overt way, questions of race in the text. I mean, that isn't to say the text isn't littered with implicit references, but here it is a little explicit. So the line here is...
Aeneas may command as many moors as in the sea are little water drops.
Which suggests, for this exercise, that Dido is a kind of ruling elite who is above and separate from, quotes, Moorish peoples, who, considering the location and the semi-colonialist origin story for the founding of Carthage, places Dido in a similar category as the depiction of Cleopatra in Egypt, which we also touched on in our season. A foreign dynasty with domination over a racially different people. Now, whilst the word fair isn't automatically a signifier of race, in conjunction with some of the other dialogue, it suggests the playwrights considered Dido and Aeneas' people to be different to the general populace of the region within the logic of the play. Now, in production, an awareness of this is important, both in casting and in what text to cut or keep. I chose to keep this line in the live show, and the audience were primed that we were presenting an early modern play. There was a brief introduction. In the final edit, and in a more general performance, consideration for an audience who isn't primed thusly, a latecomer in a hurry, is a judgment to be made. And there is another line in Act 5, which I did cut, which I'll come to next time. Anyway, having crowned Aeneas, she intends to present him to the people as a new additional ruler, which is again this power play. It's one thing to run away from a one-cave stand, but it's quite another thing to run away having been presented to the people as consort. Even here, though, Aeneas' martial mind holds sway.
And now, to make experience of my love, fair sister Anna, lead my lover forth, and seated on my jennet, let him ride as Dido's husband through the Prunic streets. And will my guard with Mauritian darts to wait upon him as their sovereign lord?
What if the citizens repine thereat?
Those that dislike what Dido gives in charge command my guard to slay for their offence. Shall vulgar peasants storm at what I do? The ground is mine. That gives them sustenance, the air wherein they breathe, the water, fire. All that they have, their lands, their goods, their lives, and I, the goddess of all these, command Aeneas ride as Carthaginian king.
Aeneas, for his parentage, deserves as large a kingdom as his Libya.
Aye, and unless the destinies be false, I shall be planted in as rich a land.
Speak, of no other land. This land is thine. Dido is thine. Henceforth, I call thee Lord. Do as I bid thee, sister. Lead the way, and from a turret I'll behold my love.
Then here in me shall flourish Priam's race. And thou and I, Achates, for revenge, for Troy, for Priam, for his 50 sons, our kinsmen's lives, 1,000 guiltless souls, will lead and host against the hateful Greeks, and fire-proud Lacedaemon o'er their heads.
So Aeneas is accepting his position. But he talks of using Carthage now as a staging post for military revenge. Dido is all about love. Aeneas is all about war. Venus and Mars. Get it? Exeunt all except Dido and the Carthaginian lords, who are basically there to be talked at. One lord will get two lines to give Dido room for an in-breath. She starts saying how great Aeneas is, and then she makes sure that the hostage she has, Ascanius, is safely guarded so that it can't escape, and remove all the bits that make a boat go. Dido knows, on some level, that she has to trap Aeneas. I mean, this isn't a healthy love between two equals. It's obsession by a queen who has power over another person. So again, we can reasonably say that Aeneas is a love rat, but Dido, because of the gods, is behaving in a way that might make any reasonable partner run for the hills. They are both lying to each other constantly. Though Dido is primarily lying to herself. Dido, you have the floor.
Speaks not Aeneas like a conqueror. Oh, blessed tempest that did drive him in. Oh, happy sand that made him run aground. Henceforth you shall be of our Carthage gods. Aye, but it may be he will leave my love and seek a foreign land called Italy. Oh, that I had a charm to keep the winds within the closure of a golden ball, or that the Tyrian sea were in mine arms, that he might suffer shipwreck on my breast, as oft as he attempts to hoist up sail. I must prevent him. Wishing will not serve. Go, bid my nurse take young Ascanius and bear him to the country to her house. Aeneas will not go without his son. Yet lest he should, for I am full of fear, bring me his oars, his tackling, and his sails.
Exit First Lord. And here Dido lampshades what I was thinking at this moment. You want to keep him? Scuttle the fleet. Dido has good reason not to. It would make her love unreasonably angry with her. Can't have that. His ire would be worse than death to her. And the pain of what Cupid has done to her and the shape of how this play will end is demonstrated to us.
What if I sink his ships? Oh, he will frown. Better he frown than I should die of grief. I cannot see him frown. It may not be. Armies of foes resolve to win this town, or impious traitors vow to have my life. Affright me not. Only Aeneas's frown is that which terrifies poor Dido's heart. No bloody spears appearing in the air presage the downfall of my empery, nor blazing comets threaten Dido's death. It is Aeneas's frown that ends my days. If he forsake me not, I'll never die. For in his looks I see eternity, and he'll make me immortal with a kiss.
Enter First Lord, with attendants carrying tackling. And here, the youngest child of the company, probably, gets his big break line.
Your nurse is gone with young Ascanius, and here's Aeneas tackling oars and sails.
Mic drop. Dido is now playful around these sails, etc., as props to be referenced in her speech. These do need some physical presence in the production, though not necessarily a whole ship's worth. I mean, you don't have to go that far. But ideally, you do want something for Dido to play with as she imagines hanging them up and sailing the palace to Italy. Well, if that happened, Aeneas will stay behind with me. Carthage is nothing to her in comparison. She moves onto the mast and oars and other elements of shipping and is clear he ain't getting away from me. Peak Cupid infatuation. Of course, a lot of this can be directed out to the audience, as though seeing these things being dragged ashore in front of her. But something I think is needed on stage for the First Lord's line, and I'm going to have fun trying to make the sound design work here for the audio version.
Are these the sails that, in despite of me, packed with the winds to bear Aeneas hence? I'll hang ye in the chamber where I lie. Drive, if you can, my house to Italy. I'll set the casement open in the winds may enter in and once again conspire against the life of me, poor Carthage queen. But though he go, he stays in Carthage still, and let rich Carthage fleet upon the seas, so I may have Aeneas in mine arms. Is this the wood that grew on Carthage plains and would be toiling in the watery billows to rob their mistress of her Trojan guest? Oh, cursed tree, hast thou but wit or sense to measure how I prize Aeneas' love, thou wast have leapt out of the sail's hands and told me that Aeneas meant to go. And yet I blame thee not, thou art but wood. The water, which our poets term a nymph, why did I suffer it, these to touch her breasts, and shrunk not back, knowing my love was there? The water is no element, no nymph. Why should I blame Aeneas for his flight? Oh, Dido, blame not him, but break his oars. These were the instruments that launched him forth. There's not so much as this bates tackling to, but dares to heap up sorrow in my heart. Was it not you that hoised up these sails? Why burst you not that they fell in the seas? For this will Dido tie ye full of knots and shear ye all asunder with her hands. Now serve you to chastise shipboys for their faults. Ye shall no more offend the Carthage queen. Now let him hang my favours on his mast and see if those will serve instead of sails. For tackling, let him take the chains of gold which I bestowed upon his followers. Instead of oars, let him use his hands and swim to Italy. I'll keep these sure. Come, bear them in.
Exempt. Yeah. This is going to go well. And that's not the end of the act. We get a little coda scene. Having mentioned Ascanius as hostage earlier, we return to the changeling Cupid as Ascanius. A nurse is leading him away, presumably to be more secure. Of course, she doesn't know this is Cupid, and this older woman will be influenced and or pricked by Cupid. Again, I see Cupid's presence as enough to drive people slightly over the edge. Just physically being there influences them, and proximity, though the prick is what pushes them off the cliff completely. It's both a slightly sweet scene and really creepy. Because the nurse is playing with the child, and because he's a god, it goes weird really quickly. Also, she's kind of kidnapping him, so she's not exactly being a great person here. Come with me, child. There are sweets.
My lord Ascanius, you must go with me.
Whither must I go? I'll stay with my mother.
No, thou shalt go with me unto my house. I have an orchard that hath store of plums, brown almonds, services, ripe figs and dates, dewberries, apples, yellow oranges. A garden where are beehives full of honey, musk roses, and a thousand sorts of flowers, and in the midst doth run a silver stream where thou shalt see the red-gilled fishes leap, white swans, and many lovely waterfowls. Now speak, Ascanius. Will you go or no?
Come, come. I'll go. How far hence is your house?
Oh, but hereby, child. We shall get thither straight.
Stranger danger, Cupid. Stranger danger. But then we get this proximity cue in the script. So the nurse is leading him on with words. Follow me, follow me. Here, have some licorice all sorts. And then he asks to be carried. And we know that when close, bad things happen.
Nurse, I am weary. Will you carry me?
Aye. So you'll dwell with me and call me mother.
So you'll love me? I care not if I do.
And here the nurse starts to go a bit weird. Though like Dido in Act 3, the effects ebb and flow. It's also a mirroring of the Act 1 scene with Jupiter and Ganymede, an older figure dandling a young would-be lover.
The time I live to see this boy a man. How prettily he laughs. Go, you wag. You'll be a twigger when you come to age. Say Dido what she will. I am not old. I'll be no more a widow. I am young. I'll have a husband. Or else a lover.
A husband? And no teeth. Oh,
what mean I to have such foolish thoughts? Foolish is love, a toy. Oh, sacred love. If there be any heaven in earth, 'tis love. Especially in a woman of your years. Oh, blush, blush for shame. Why shouldst thou think of love? A grave and not a lover fits thy age. A grave? Why, I may live 100 years. 80 is but a girl's age. Love is sweet. Oh, my veins are withered and my sinews dry. Why do I think of love? Now I should die.
Come, nurse.
Well, if he come a-wooing, he shall speed. Oh, how unwise was I to say him nay.
And exeunt. And at the end of the play, Cupid is leading her off. She is resisting these thoughts and speaking of desire in age. And love overcomes. Again, none of these things are love. They are that rush, the hormonal lust and obsession, Cupid as drug pusher, his arrow and needle full of teenage angst. We will see the nurse again, and it's not going to go well for her. So, in 5 fleeting scenes, the conflict has come into its own. It isn't lingering often. The sketch that is Iarbas and Anna's relationship is perhaps too fleeting, but otherwise this is rolling along and just full of dramatic potential. Next time, Act 5, and the long final scene, building towards the set-piece action that you need to think about from the off when planning a production. You really need to start with Act 5 when planning your production, which is awkward because we've only just got to it. And that's it from this spoilers episode for Act 4 of Dido. If you have any thoughts about my brief breakdown of the text, or if you have any disagreements with my thoughts, or if I'm in plain error, let me know. I might re-edit based on your thoughts, or not. In a moment you will hear the rough-cut plain text uninterrupted, but if you'd like more on this play, there are exploring sessions galore on the YouTube, links in the show description. The full cast audio adaptation of this will follow soon, so keep an ear out. The recording used throughout this episode is a live mix of the performed play. It's a rough mix, and focuses on the text as writ, so the final release will be cleaner and a more entertaining listen. In the version used throughout this recording, the cast was as follows. Sojourner Hazelwood Connell, Dido. Kit Maguire, Aeneas. Karim Cromfley, Iarbas. Alex Capilla, Anna. Lindsay Beecham, Ilioneus. Keith Hill, Achates. Alexandra Katagida, Cloanthus. Emma Kemp, Cupid. Simon Nader, First Lord. Sarah Blake, as Nurse. The technical operator for the production was Valentina Vinci, and the producer was myself, Robert Crichton. And now I leave you with the rough cut of Act 4 of Dido, Queen of Carthage by Christopher Marlowe and Thomas Nash.
Did ever men see such a sudden storm, or day so clear, so suddenly o'ercast?
I think some fell enchantress dwelleth here. that can call them forth whenas she please and dive into Black Tempest's treasury whenas she means to mask the world with clouds.
In all my life I never knew the like. It hailed, it snowed, it lightened all at once.
I think it was the devil's revelling night there was such hurly-burly in the heavens. Doubtless Apollo's axle-tree is cracked, or aged Atlas' shoulder out of joint, the motion was so over-violent.
In all this coil, where have you left the queen?
Nay, where's my warlike father? Can you tell?
Behold, where both of them come forth the cave.
Come forth the cave. Can heaven endure this sight? Iarbus, curse that unrevenging Jove, whose flinty dart slept in Typhus' den, whilst these adulterers surfeited with sin. Nature, why mates be not some poisonous beast, that with the sharpness of my edged sting I might have staked them both unto the earth whilst they were sporting in this darksome cave.
The air is clear, and the southern winds are whist. Come, Dido, let us hasten to the town, since gloomy Aeolus doth cease to frown.
Achates and Ascanius, well met.
Fair Anna, how escaped you from the shower?
As others did. By running to the wood.
But where were you, Iarbus, all this while?
Not with Aeneas in the ugly cave.
I see. Aeneas sticketh in your mind. But I will soon put by that stumbling block and quell those hopes that thus employ your cares.
Come, servants. Come, bring forth the sacrifice, that I may pacify that gloomy Jove, whose empty altars have enlarged our ills. Eternal Jove, great master of the clouds, father of gladness and all frolic thoughts, that with thy gloomy hand corrects the heaven when airy creatures war amongst themselves. Hear, hear, oh, hear Iarbus' plaining prayers, whose hideous echoes make the welkin howl, and all the woods Eliza to resound. The woman that thou willed us entertain, where straying in our borders up and down, she craved a hide of ground to build a town, with whom we did divide both laws and land, and all the fruits that plenty else sends forth. Scorning our loves and royal marriage rites, yields up her beauty to a stranger's bed, who, having wrought her shame, is straightway fled. Now, if thou be'st a pitying god of power, on whom ruth and compassion ever waits, redress these wrongs, and warn him to his ships that now afflicts me with his flattering eyes.
How now, Iarbus? At your prayers so hard?
Aye, Anna. Is there aught you would with me?
Nay, no such weighty business of import, but may be slacked until another time. Yet, if you would partake with me the cause of this devotion that detaineth you, I would be thankful for such courtesy.
Anna, against this Trojan do I pray, who seeks to rob me of thy sister's love, and dive into her heart by coloured looks.
Alas, poor king, that labours so in vain, for her that so delighteth in thy pain. Be ruled by me, and seek some other love, whose yielding heart may yield thee more relief.
Mine eye is fixed, where fancy cannot start. Oh, leave me. Leave me to my silent thoughts that register the numbers of my ruth, and I will either move the thoughtless flint or drop out both mine eyes in drizzling tears before my sorrow's tide have any stint.
I will not leave Iarbus, whom I love.
in this delight of dying pensiveness. Away with Dido! Anna, be thy song! Anna, that doth admire thee more than heaven.
I may, nor will list to such loathsome change that intercepts the course of my desire. Servants, come fetch these empty vessels here, for I will fly from these alluring eyes that do pursue my peace where'er it goes.
Iarbas, stay! Loving Iarbas, stay! For I have honey to present thee with. Hard-hearted will not deign to hear me speak. I'll follow thee with outcries nevertheless, and strew thy walks with my dishevelled hair.
Carthage, my friendly host, adieu. Since destiny doth call me from thy shore, Hermes this night, descending in a dream, hath summoned me to fruitful Italy. Jove wills it so, my mother wills it so. Let my Phoenicia grant, and then I go. Grant she or no, Aeneas must away, whose golden fortunes, clogged with courtly ease, cannot ascend to fame's immortal house, or banquet in bright honour's burnished hall, till he hath furrowed Neptune's glassy fields, and cut a passage through his topless hills. Achates, come forth! Segestus, Ilioneus, Cloanthus, haste away! Aeneas calls.
What wills our lord, or wherefore did he call?
The dreams, brave mates, that did beset my bed when sleep but newly had embraced the night, commands me leave these unrenowned realms, whereas nobility abhors to stay, and none but base Aeneas will abide. Abhorred, abhorred, since fates do bid abhorred, and slice the sea with sable-coloured ships, on whom the nimble winds may all day wait, and follow them as footmen through the deep. Yet Dido casts her eyes like anchors out to stay my fleet from loosing forth the bay. Come back, I hear her cry afar, and let me link thy body to my lips, that tied together by the striving tongues we may as one sail into Italy.
Banish that ticing dame from forth your mouth and follow your foreseeing stars in all. This is no life for men-at-arms to live, where dalliance doth consume a soldier's strength and wanton motions of alluring eyes effeminate our minds inured to war.
Why, let us build a city of our own and not stand lingering here for amorous looks. Will Dido raise old Priam forth his grave and build the town again the Greeks did burn? No, no, she cares not how we sink or swim, so she may have Aeneas in her arms.
To Italy, sweet friends, to Italy! We will not stay a minute longer here.
Trojans aboard, and I will follow you. I fain would go, yet beauty calls me back. To leave her so, and not once say farewell, were to transgress against all laws of love. But if I use such ceremonious thanks as parting friends accustom on the shore, her silver arms will call me round about, and tears of pearls cry, stay, Aeneas, stay. Each word she says will then contain a crown, and every speech be ended with a kiss. I may not endure this female drudgery. To sea, Aeneas. Find out Italy.
Oh, Anna, run unto the waterside. They say Aeneas's men are going aboard. It may be he will steal away with them. Stay not to answer me. Run, Anna, run. Oh, foolish Trojans that would steal from hence and not let Dido understand their drift. I would have given Achates store of gold and Ilioneus gum and Libyan spice, the common soldiers rich embroidered coats and silver whistles to control the winds which Circe sent Sichaeus when he lived. Unworthy are they of a queen's reward. See where they come. How might I do to chide?
'Twas time to run. Aeneas had been gone. The sails were hoisting up and he aboard.
Is this thy love for me?
Princely Dido, give me leave to speak. I went to take my farewell of Achates.
How haps Achates bid me not farewell?
Because I feared your grace would keep me here.
To rid thee of that doubt, aboard again! I charge thee, put to sea and stay not here.
Then let Aeneas go aboard with us.
Get you aboard! Aeneas means to stay.
The sea is rough. The winds blow to the shore.
Oh, false Aeneas. Now the sea is rough. But when you were aboard, 'twas calm enough. Thou and Achates meant to sail away.
Hath not the Carthage queen mine only son? Thinks Dido I will go and leave him here.
Aeneas, pardon me, for I forgot that young Ascanius lay with me this night. Love made me jealous. But to make amends, wear the imperial crown of Libya. Sway thou the Punic scepter in my stead and punish me, Aeneas, for this crime.
This kiss shall be fair Dido's punishment.
Oh, how a crown becomes Aeneas's head. Stay here, Aeneas, and command as king.
How vain am I to wear this diadem and bear this golden sceptre in my hand? A burgess of steel and not a crown, a sword and not a sceptre fits Aeneas.
Oh, keep them still and let me gaze my fill. Now looks Aeneas like a mortal Jove. Oh, where is Ganymede to hold his cup and Mercury to fly for what he calls? 10,000 cupids hover in the air and fan it in Aeneas' lovely face. Oh, that the clouds were where he in the, that fleds, and thou and I unseen might sport ourselves. Heaven, envious of our joys, is waxen pale, and when we whisper, then the stars fall down to be partakers in our honey talk.
Oh, Dido, patroness of all our lives, when I leave thee, death be my punishment. Swell, raging seas, frown wayward destinies, blow winds, threaten ye rocks and sandy shelves. This is the harbour that Aeneas seeks. Let's see what tempests can annoy me now.
Oh, not all the world can take thee from mine arms. Aeneas may command as many moors as in the sea are little water drops. And now, to make experience of my love, fair sister Anna, lead my lover forth, and seated on my jennet, let him ride as Dido's husband through the Punic streets. And will my guard with Mauritian darts to wait upon him as their sovereign lord.
What if the citizens repine thereat?
Those that dislike what Dido gives in charge command my guard to slay for their offence. Shall vulgar peasants storm at what I do? The ground is mine. That gives them sustenance, the air wherein they breathe, the water, fire. All that they have, their lands, their goods, their lives, and I, the goddess of all these, command Aeneas ride as Carthaginian king.
Aeneas, for his parentage, deserves as large a kingdom as his Libya.
Aye, and unless the destinies be false, I shall be planted in as rich a land.
Speak of no other land. This land is thine. Dido is thine. Henceforth, I call thee Lord. Do as I bid thee, sister. Lead the way, and from a turret I'll behold my love.
Then here in me shall flourish Priam's race. And thou and I, Achates, for revenge, for Troy, for Priam, for his 50 sons, our kinsmen's lives, 1,000 guiltless souls, will lead and host against the hateful Greeks, and fire-proud Lacedaemon o'er their heads.
Speaks not Aeneas like a conqueror. Oh, blessed tempest that did drive him in. Oh, happy sand that made him run aground. Henceforth you shall be of our Carthage gods. Aye, but it may be he will leave my love and seek a foreign land called Italy. Oh, that I had a charm to keep the winds within the closure of a golden ball, or that the Tyrian sea were in mine arms, that he might suffer shipwreck on my breast, as oft as he attempts to hoist up sail. I must prevent him. Wishing will not serve. Go, bid my nurse take young Ascanius and bear him to the country to her house. Aeneas will not go without his son. Yet lest he should, for I am full of fear, bring me his oars, his tackling, and his sails. What if I sink his ships? Oh, he will frown. Better he frown than I should die of grief. I cannot see him frown. It may not be. Armies of foes resolve to win this town, or impious traitors vow to have my life. Affright me not. Only Aeneas's frown is that which terrifies poor Dido's heart. No bloody spears appearing in the air presage the downfall of my empery, nor blazing comets threaten Dido's death. It is Aeneas's frown that ends my days. If he forsake me not, I'll never die. For in his looks I see eternity, and he'll make me immortal with a kiss.
Your nurse is gone with young Ascanius, and here's Aeneas tackling oars and sails.
Are these the sails that, in despite of me, packed with the winds to bear Aeneas hence? I'll hang ye in the chamber where I lie. Drive, if you can, my house to Italy. I'll set thee a casement open in the winds, may enter in, and once again conspire against the life of me, poor Carthage queen. But though ye go, he stays in Carthage still, and let rich Carthage fleet upon the seas, so I may have Aeneas in mine arms. Is this the wood that grew on Carthage plains and would be toiling in the watery billows to rob their mistress of her Trojan guest? Oh, cursed tree, hast thou but wit or sense to measure how I prize Aeneas's love? Thou wast have leapt out of the sail's hands and told me that Aeneas meant to go. And yet I blame thee not, thou art but wood. The water, which our poets term a nymph, why did I suffer it, these to touch her breasts, and shrunk not back, knowing my love was there? The water is no element, no nymph. Why should I blame Aeneas for his flight? Dido, blame not him, but break his oars. These were the instruments that launched him forth. There's not so much as this bates tackling to, but dares to heap up sorrow in my heart. Was it not you that hoised up these sails? Why burst you not that they fell in the seas? For this will Dido tie ye full of knots and shear ye all asunder with her hands. Now serve you to chastise shipboys for their faults. Ye shall no more offend the Carthage queen. Now, let him hang my favours on his mast, and see if those will serve instead of sails. For tackling, let him take the chains of gold which I bestowed upon his followers. Instead of oars, let him use his hands and swim to Italy. I'll keep these sure. Come, bear them in.
My lord Ascanius, you must go with me.
Whither must I go? I'll stay with my mother.
No, thou shalt go with me unto my house. I have an orchard that hath store of plums, brown almonds, services, ripe figs and dates, dewberries, apples, yellow oranges. A garden where are beehives full of honey, musk roses, and a thousand sorts of flowers, and in the midst doth run a silver stream where thou shalt see the red-gilled fishes leap, white swans, and many lovely waterfowls. Now speak, Ascanius. Will you go or no?
Come, come, I'll go. How far hence is your house?
Oh, but hereby, child, we shall get thither straight.
Nurse, I am weary. Will you carry me?
Aye, so you'll dwell with me and call me mother.
So you'll love me? I care not if I do.
Oh, that I might live to see this boy a man. How prettily he laughs. Go, you wag. You'll be a twigger when you come to age. Say Dido what she will. I am not old. I'll be no more a widow. I am young. I'll have a husband, or else a lover.
A husband and no teeth. Oh,
what mean I to have such foolish thoughts? Foolish is love, a toy. Oh, sacred love. If there be any heaven in earth, 'tis love. Especially in a woman of your years. Oh, blush, blush for shame.
Why shouldst thou think of love? A grave, and not a lover, fits thy age. A grave? Why, I may live 100 years. 80 is but a girl's age. Love is sweet. Oh, my veins are withered and my sinews dry. Why do I think of love? Now I should die.
Come, nurse.
Well, if he come a-wooing, he shall speed. Oh, how unwise was I to say him nay.
This spoilers episode was hosted and produced by myself, Robert Crichton, for the Beyond podcast. Follow us on social media at Beyond Shakes. Visit our website at beyondshakespeare.org or support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Links in the show description.